According to a survey of Texans interested in the news, a majority say they now have grave questions about the usefulness of polling. Some questions answered today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.
I'm David Brown. Is there a speaker in the House? Very soon there'll be a new one. Ross Ramsey of the Texas Tribune on the growing line of lawmakers seeking the top job in Texas's lower chamber. Anti-social media, the role of Twitter, Facebook, and the rest in the information wars leading up to the election and beyond. And as COVID cases spike again in parts of Texas, a would-be hero emerges from the Alamo City, a virus-killing robot. All those stories and a whole lot more when the Texas Standard gets underway. Right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard time on this fifth day of November 2020. I'm David Brown. Anyone up for another election season in Texas? What if I told you it's already underway and you likely won't get to cast a ballot, absentee or otherwise? Both statements are true in this case, and the outcome of this political campaign season, now entering what promises to be a heated phase, will likely have far-reaching effects on virtually every Texan. So here's the deal. Texas lawmakers are set to return to Austin in January for the start of a new legislative session. When the gavel falls in the Texas House, one of the first orders of business will be the selection of a new leader, the Speaker of the Texas House. That person will be one of the three most powerful political figures in all of Texas, right after the governor and the lieutenant governor who heads up the Texas Senate. You may recall that Dennis Bonin, the current Texas House Speaker, announced last year he'd retire from the post following a political scandal. Now that the general election's mostly over and the Democrats' hoped-for blue wave came crashing somewhat short of the shore, the field of possible replacements for Bonin appeared to quickly consolidate into two camps. How this new leader will be chosen and who that person might be is the focus of a certain amount of political intrigue at the moment, especially given the stakes. The Texas Tribune has been covering this drama, much of it occurring behind the scenes, and to help us all peek under the curtain, the executive editor and co-founder of the Texas Tribune, Ross Ramsey. Ross, welcome back.
Hi, David. How are you?
I'm fine. Happy birthday to the Texas Tribune. Launched this week, what, how many years ago?
11 years ago.
11 years ago. It's
hard
amazing.
To believe, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. TexasTribune.org if you want to celebrate. Those who don't follow the inside baseball of the Texas Ledge, how does this process of selecting a Texas speaker normally play out? It starts when?
It starts right after an election. It starts a little bit before an election. As soon as they know that there is going to be a vacancy, they start kind of quietly campaigning. And it works really just like a very high-profile, high-stakes student council election. You know, there's 150 voters in the Texas House. They vote amongst themselves. This year was a little bit odd because there was some question about whether the Democrats or the Republicans would have the majority in the Texas House, and that kind of froze everybody a little bit. But when it became apparent on election night that the Democrats' numbers were not going to increase and that it was going to be a Republican speaker, things fell into shape very, very quickly. The Democratic candidates got out. The Republican candidates, as you noted, have consolidated into two camps. And we're off to the races.
Tell us about those two camps. One of them is held by Representative Dade Phelan of Beaumont, right?
Right. And he says he's got 82 votes, which would be plenty. You need 76 to control. And if he's right and they stick until we get to the second Tuesday in January, then he'll be the next speaker. But there's another group that's consolidated behind Jeannie Morrison. She's a state representative from Victoria, been in the House for some time now. And they're arguing that, you know, we should have the first woman speaker, it should be a Republican, and it shouldn't be Dade Phelan. You know, behind this, you've got, you know, factions within the Republican Party in the House, and they're each going to have to appeal to some extent to Democrats to get the 76 votes that they need. Right now, it looks like advantage Phelan, but we've got weeks and weeks to go.
Is there any substantive difference when it comes to policies or the way that they govern that one can discern?
Not really. I mean, I think these are both from the same part of the majority party. The majority party is pretty well established in the House and in the legislature. The set of issues before the legislature is pretty clear this time. They've got a bad budget, redistricting, and some other issues. I don't know that outside of the House there's going to be a real difference here. I think on the inside of the House, It's all about, you know, if I vote for candidate A, I'm situated like this. If I vote for candidate B, I'm situated like that. It comes down to personal ambition and what each member of the legislature thinks is going to be the best candidate for their own ambitions and you know, getting their what they promised their constituents through the House.
And when we talk about personal ambition, we're talking about what, chairmanship posts and that sort of thing?
Right. How do my bills do? What chairman, what committees am I on? Do I get to chair a committee? How am I situated in the power structure? You know, when you rearrange the speakership, you rearrange all the chairs.
But of course, this is a high stakes matter, especially when we're talking about the prospect of redistricting. And that happens this session, right?
Right. So redistricting, they draw the political maps for the next, you know, 10 years if it holds up in court. And as soon as they do that, they start refiguring everybody's district. And if you're on the in, your district will look pretty good. And if you're not on the in, you'll be trading material. So one of the things here is, how do I do in this session? Another of the things here is, and what kind of map are we drawing and how will I figure into that? So there's a lot at stake for the members that may be invisible to the public to some extent.
There's a lot at stake for the public, too, especially in a session that's going to be dealing with a real budget crisis.
We have a multi-billion dollar shortfall in the current budget, which goes through the end of August. And the legislature that comes in January will write the next two-year budget, which we expect is going to be pretty skinny because the economy is hurting. So they're looking at, are we going to have to do cuts? Are we going to have to find new money somewhere? Are we going to have to do some combination of those things? It's a very tense political session.
Ross Ramsey is the executive editor and co-founder of the Texas Tribune, texastribune.org. Ross, thanks again.
Appreciate it, David.
It is the question on everyone's mind right now. Well, maybe not that question, but a close second. What's happened to polling? For many, it seems that for the second presidential election in a row, the pollsters got it wrong. So what does this mean going forward? Here to talk with us, a man who holds what might be a somewhat unenviable job at the moment. He is a pollster himself. Joshua Blank is the research director at the Texas Politics Project. Josh, I'm just joshing with you. Great to have you back.
Thanks for having me again.
Let me read something that Nate Cohn wrote in the New York Times one day before the general election, and I mentioned this yesterday. Here's the quote. President Trump needs a very large polling error to have a hope of winning the White House. Joe Biden would win even if polls were off by as much as they were in 2016. And when this was written, 10 p.m. on November 1st, it had Biden up by 9. And if the polls were as wrong as they were in 2016, he would have been up by 7. So that's a margin of error that margins of error don't usually capture. What went wrong?
Well, I think we're still trying to figure that out. And I think we're also still trying to figure out, you know, the scope of the error. I mean, I think a lot of people pointed this out, and I'm going to be another one, which is to remind people that, you know, not all the votes have been counted yet. Having said that, I'm not trying to you know, look at this with rose-colored glasses. The polls were off. I mean, there's no doubt about that. And if you look across really most of the competitive states, and really, and it doesn't matter whether it was a Democratic-controlled state or Republican-controlled state, it doesn't matter, you know, how they collected their ballots, whether it had extensive early voting or mail-in voting, same-day registration. Ultimately, it seemed that they were all biased, you know, mm-hmm. against Trump by about 4 points on average.
Now, when you say biased against Trump, I think the assumption of a lot of people is that there isn't a bias factor here, that people are asked a series of questions and those answers are dutifully put down in a notebook and you collect the data and what you get is what you get. Do people just lie to pollsters? What's going on?
Well, I should be a little bit more careful here. When we talk about bias as pollsters, we're talking about systematic error. We're talking about, you know, estimates that consistently overpredict someone's performance or consistently underpredict someone's performance. It's not that, you know, pollsters are putting their thumb on the scale and trying to adjust the mm-hmm. results. It's just that consistently we find that, you know, the polls are, you know, again, pushing in one direction or another. And that is a problem. Ultimately, we're okay with random error because random error cancels out. Systemic error is a problem. And that's what I think pollsters are going to spend the next few days, weeks, and months trying to uncover. You know, to your point here, you know, what's causing this? I think there are sort of three kind of big, you know, theories right now out there, and none of them are mutually exclusive. One is this idea that there were shy Trump voters, that, you know, that there was social pressure against Trump voters to express their opinions. To be honest, there's not a ton of evidence for this. This is not a theory that pollsters have generated. This is a theory that's been more generated by kind of opinion leaders. And pollsters have looked into this a lot and found very little evidence. Another possibility is that there's a non-response bias among Trump supporters, essentially that there are some people who are more or less likely to answer polls. And if that, you know, it relates to your vote choice, that could cause a problem, either if, you know, Trump voters are less likely to respond to polls or if Biden supporters were more likely to respond to polls. The third possible source of error in all this is the likely voter model. Ultimately, you know, there's something about campaign polling that's very different from other kinds of polling generally. Generally, when we poll people and survey them, we know a lot about that population. We know a lot about what registered voters in Texas look like. We know a lot about what the population of the United States looks like. Mm-hmm. You know, what the electorate that eventually emerges out of that on election day, that's something that we are forced to guess about. And in a historic election with historic turnout and, you know, I think multiple historical crises facing the country at the same time, it's very difficult for pollsters to go out and say, this is what the electorate's going to look like. And so ultimately, you know, you are seeing a lot of guesstimates at some point, and you have to be honest and you have to be humble about that.
We'll have more of our conversation over at texasstandard.org. There's a lot to dig into here. Joshua Blank, Research Director of the Texas Politics Project. Josh, thanks for speaking with us.
Anytime.
He's monitoring the Talk of Texas on this Thursday, our social media editor, Wells Dunbar.
Well, as a wise man once said, waiting is the hardest part, and that's being borne out on social media, where our friends and listeners are waiting on results in the presidential election. Joe Biden currently poised at 264 per the AP, potentially set to hit that magic number of 270 should a lead in Nevada hold. On our Facebook page, Amanda Dietz Coelho asks, why are some states faster at counting than others? President Trump lashing out on Twitter, tweeting, among other missives, to stop the count, a message we should add that carries no force of law. Sharon Nayland Slimmons on our Facebook page says, let them keep counting. Why try to stop this? I understand requesting a recount, but all votes must be counted first. And Mario Modesto says, I'm confident the counting will be as accurate as humanly possible. These are our fellow citizens performing a civic duty for the good of the country. Let's give them our patience and support. Being an instant gratification society doesn't help, though. And there is something to that. Just some of the reactions we're seeing out there, David. I'll be back with more on this and other stories from around the web later in the broadcast.
What do you make of the wait, Texas? We'd love to hear from you. Tweet us, or look for us on Facebook or your social media platform of choice. Texas Standard is what you're looking for. Wells Dunbar is looking for you. Our social media editor will be joining us once again in about 35 minutes or so with a whole lot more of the Talk of Texas.
Support for Texas Standard comes from TCU. Stories of Horned Frog changemakers like Amiso George, who is helping organizations navigate COVID-19 crisis communications, can be found at tcu.edu/teamwork.
Business and your money on the Standard. A state agency was set to take over Houston's Hurricane Harvey housing recovery efforts, but that's not happening as planned. You may recall there's been tension between the two sides, with the city suing the GLO, which had criticized Houston City Administration for moving too slowly in distributing funds allocated to help rebuild homes damaged during the 2017 storm. Well, last year, the GLO took control of the Harris County Recovery Program on top of similar programs it already administered in 48 other counties, and got approval from the Federal Department of Housing and Urban Development to take over the grant program in Texas's biggest city as well. Now, under a deal approved by all sides, Houston is dropping its lawsuit. The GLO is taking over a $428 million part of the program aimed at repairing and replacing single-family homes, but Houston will hang on to an $825 million portion of the fund for multifamily rentals, homeowner assistance, and buyout programs. Houston Chronicle reports today's agreed-upon deadlines being put on hold for 30 days to give both sides a chance to iron out the handoff.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider, proud to be on the job with essential workers who are out there working safe and keeping Texas strong. More at texasmutual.com/onthejob.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. You may recall back in 2016, Facebook drawing sharp criticism for permitting political misinformation on its platform, fake news, to spread around. Officials for Facebook and Twitter have each said since, repeatedly, they were going to clamp down on news coming from questionable sources and similar stuff spread by politicians themselves. Facebook has banned some accounts, and since this week's election, Twitter has labeled tweets from President Trump and members of his inner circle as inaccurate. Still, both platforms have been criticized for not doing enough and, in some cases, for doing too much. Our tech expert Omar Gayaga has some thoughts about how the platforms have tried to evolve. Omar, welcome back.
Hey, thank you, David.
Is it fair to say that on Facebook and Twitter, 2020 was a very different place for fake news? What's changed since 2016?
I think the biggest change is that we know. We know that this misinformation is going to be posted. The companies know that it's coming. The question is just, what are they doing about it? How are they responding? Both Twitter and Facebook and several other social media networks said in advance, you know, we're going to clamp down. We're going to, you know, take this seriously and do something about it. So now all of the tech experts and you know, critics have been just watching to see how they respond to instances like, say, the president of the United States, say, declaring victory before the votes have been counted, as he did early Wednesday morning. So it's been very, very interesting to watch. And I think the difference is just the response level, just how quickly they respond to these things.
Well, let's talk about what's been happening this week. The president, his press secretary, and a Democratic official in Wisconsin were all among those accused of making false or misleading claims about the election. What happened to those posts?
Labeling has been the strategy for this election cycle, especially from Twitter. It's to label these posts as misinformation, to make them harder to retweet or pass on, to give people a warning before they share that, or making them unshareable at all. That happened several times with the president's post, also from posts from some of his staff. But it also happened to a Democratic operative who had declared that Joe Biden had won the election early. So that is what Twitter's strategy has been to kind of let people know this is not, you know, accurate information. Here's a link to some better information. That's what YouTube has done. Facebook has been a little bit different because they have sort of not been as quick to do that and been a little bit more hands-off. But generally what's happening this year is just a big label appearing on and not suspending or getting rid of those accounts.
It's a tough thing to do, though. I mean, you know, you become the police of other people's speech, right? I mean, for instance, it's often been said that a lot of President Trump's supporters don't take what he says literally. They take it figuratively. So when he says, I've won this election, to some, that may sound like I'm gonna win, which is precisely what the other candidate had to say about his prospects. Hasn't that proven to be a tricky thing for Facebook and Twitter to try to balance?
Yeah, I think Facebook in particular, Mark Zuckerberg, the chief executive, has said that he believes it's a free speech issue and that he doesn't want to fact check the president or other political figures. And so it becomes an issue of, okay, then what do you do then if you're not going to get, you know, if you're not going to delete that content or suspend those accounts? How do you let people know that this is not okay information, that this is not information that is accurate or reflect a reflection of reality? So Facebook has done the same thing as Twitter, which is to label these posts, but they've been much slower on the draw, especially with those videos that were happening late Tuesday night. They waited until the next morning to even label them. So they've been a little more hands-off and have gotten some criticism for that, for not being as quick or as responsive as Twitter has been.
Well, has that affected the way that Facebook and Twitter react? Because they do have two different philosophies on this question.
It has, and it's also caused people to kind of find ways around that. People who are, for instance, supporters of the president would copy and paste that information and post it on their own accounts, and then those accounts also get flagged, but sometimes they don't. Sometimes they change the wording or they change it slightly so that it's not caught. One place where we're seeing these social networks really miss the mark is on Spanish language content. Is that their filters seem to not be picking up a lot of misleading and bad information being done in Spanish. So they may need to hire some translators or some people who are native speakers, because those posts seem to be getting less flagged and more passed on. And so that's becoming a real problem this election cycle.
We should touch on the mechanics of this, because you talk about filters. Is this being done by human beings who are reading the tweets and making determinations, or is it being done automatically by robots?
It's largely being done by algorithms, largely being done by kind of finding these keywords. But they also have hired a lot of people to kind of do this manually. And especially when it's coming from an account like the president's, it's definitely Twitter from the top saying, yeah, no, we're going to label this. And I imagine, you know, when it comes to that particular Twitter account, that they are doing it on a case-by-case basis, that they're doing it very carefully and cautiously.
Where's Google, which owns YouTube, in all this? I mean, does YouTube moderate content? I mean, a lot of providers, a lot of people who make content think that it's has a rather heavy hand.
Google made an announcement a few months ago that they were going to suspend all political ads on their platform after the election so that there wouldn't be kind of a skewing of results. But on YouTube, it's a little bit weirder because they have sort of separated the idea of what is misleading information that needs to be banned entirely and what is misleading information that just needs to be demonetized. So there are some very controversial videos out there claiming one or the other was victorious. And they were not taken down, they were not banned, but they were demonetized. That means that the content creator cannot make money from those videos. So YouTube has a little bit stranger policies because they it's a very big deal to be able to make money from videos on YouTube, and that's sort of been their battering stick is to take away the money stream for people who are posting bad content or misleading content.
Do you think it's safe to say that perhaps, I mean, we're talking about what's happening from the candidates themselves, but we haven't touched at all on what was a real thorn during 2016, and that was in the involvement of other countries in a methodical attempt to try to undermine the presidential sweepstakes. I don't recall seeing a lot of overt disinformation. Then again, maybe other countries have gotten better at trying to avoid those filters.
Yeah, we know that. We know that the efforts are getting more sophisticated, harder to detect. I believe I'd seen some things about some Iranian interference earlier this week. But yeah, I mean, that's one of those things where we may not know for months what was happening or how bad it was until some of that comes out. We certainly didn't know until well after the 2016 election how extensive that interference was. So that's something where it may be so sophisticated, we just don't know yet.
When he's not scrolling through his Twitter feed, you can find Omar Gayaga at TechMinuteTexas.com. Omar, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas Tuition Promise Fund. For over 10 years, helping families lock in current tuition rates and required fees at Texas public colleges and universities, excluding medical and dental institutions. TexasTuitionPromiseFund.com.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. Republicans are maintaining their significant majority on the Texas State Board of Education following the election Tuesday. But of the 8 seats up for grabs, Democrats did flip one previously held by a Republican. Texas State University professor Rebecca Bell Metteroux narrowly defeated GOP candidate Lainey Popp for District 5 seat, which stretches from Austin to the San Antonio area. Bell Metteroux told Texas Public Radio she's eager to get started.
And I want to have a very collegial and cooperative working system, and I want to bring my love of research and of hearing a lot of voices to the State Board of Education.
Board members determine the curriculum taught in Texas public schools. An El Paso district court judge is considering whether a 2-week shutdown of non-essential businesses is legal. As KTEP's Angela Kachurga reports, a group of local restaurant owners and the Texas Attorney General asked for an injunction on Wednesday.
The legal battle centers on whether El Paso County Judge Ricardo Samaniego has the authority to issue his emergency order shutting down non-essential businesses. The order took effect last week as hospitals were filling up with COVID patients. The attorney general's lawyer argued only the governor has that power. Mark Osborne is the attorney representing the restaurant owners.
The county judge and the governor must work together to serve us, all of the people of the state and of our county. And that's true now more than ever.
District Court Judge William Moody allowed this rare use of audio from the hearing, which was on YouTube. He said he will rule on the injunction request by Friday. I'm Angela Kocherga in El Paso.
Like El Paso, Amarillo's medical facilities are also overwhelmed by coronavirus patients. They account for 31% of hospitalizations in the area. Amarillo Public Health Director Casey Stoughton says that number is startling.
We've got to ease hospital capacity. We've got to ease the burden on our healthcare workers so that they can help us care for us.
Amarillo has exceeded the 15% hospitalization threshold the governor set to further reopen businesses for over 2 weeks now. And the Houston Texans are again closing their facility after another team member tested positive for the coronavirus. The NFL team said last night the player is self-isolating and staff are tracing his recent contacts. The Texans had to temporarily shut down their facility last week when another player tested positive for COVID-19. The team is scheduled to play the Jaguars in Jacksonville on Sunday.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from the University of Texas at Dallas, where 4 million square feet in new or renovated space has been added in the past decade. More at utdallas.edu/bright. UT Dallas, moving at the speed of bright.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. As COVID-19 cases continue to skyrocket in El Paso, business is booming for a San Antonio company that claims to have developed a COVID-killing robot. It's said to eliminate the virus that causes COVID-19, both in the air and on surfaces, with a burst of UV light. Texas Public Radio's Brian Kirkpatrick reports the robot was first sold to hospitals, but it's finding a broader customer base.
It's really important for these robots to be able to move all around the hospital.
That is Morris Miller, CEO of Xenex Disinfection Services, talking about the Light Strike robot.
With the head down, people frequently say it looks just like R2-D2 from the Star Wars movies. When the head is up, it's about shoulder height, and it looks like Rosie the Robot from the Jetsons.
The company started in 2009, selling the mobile robot to medical facilities to kill common hospital superbugs, bacteria, and viruses within minutes.
It has a special xenon lamp inside it. It puts out intense bursts of broad-spectrum UV light. It destroys pathogens at whatever wavelength they're most vulnerable.
After the robot is powered up, its head rises from its body. A 360-degree halo of UV light then flashes from its neck. The UV light travels far, but its most effective virus-killing range falls in a 14-foot diameter. Xenex says the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston and Minnesota's Mayo Clinic both studied and then purchased the robots. MD Anderson was the company's first client. In 2014, the hospital that treated the first Ebola victim in the U.S., Texas Health Presbyterian Dallas, used the robot to disinfect rooms where the patient was treated. Xenex says many medical studies back up the robot's effectiveness. The robot makes a tick-tock sound as it sanitizes. An attendant can wheel the robot from one area of a hospital to another, switch it on, and then step outside as it flashes away.
When it pulses, it's like a flash from a 1950s or 60s movie where the photographer says, hold it, and poof, the flash goes off.
Dr. Mark Pavroznik is a vice president and chairman at West Virginia Medicine United Hospital Center. His hospital uses the robots along with traditional cleaning crews to disinfect most areas. He says they also use the robot to sanitize medical masks that were in tight supply at the beginning of the COVID-19 outbreak around the spring.
We were able to essentially operationalize mass disinfection in about a day and preserve thousands of masks during the early pandemic when our staff needed them the most.
Shortly after COVID-19 struck, Xenex found the UV light from the robot could kill the virus that causes it in 2 minutes. Texas Biomed in San Antonio successfully tested the robot against the virus in April of this year. The robot is regulated by the Environmental Protection Agency, which oversees the disinfectant industry. When the pandemic hit, Xenex reports the market for the $125,000 robot exploded beyond medical facilities. Xenex says the robot can now be found in schools, hotels, airports, government offices, convention centers, office buildings, luxury high-rises, police stations, and jails around the world. Workers at its San Antonio factory are busy putting robots in crates to be shipped out. CEO Miller says business is booming.
We've grown our employee base about 30% since the start of the pandemic, and our sales are up about 600%.
The San Antonio International Airport became the first airport in the world to use the robot this summer. The city's director of airports, Jesus Sainz, says they run the robot 24/7 to sanitize common areas and high traffic areas.
It's really fast. It can disinfect a large area in approximately 10 to 15 minutes without a warm-up or cool-down system.
Sines says there is hardly a spot the robot does not go.
We can use it in an abundance of different places, jet bridges, gate areas, the concessions, all the ticket counters, the TSA checkpoint, our elevators and escalators, our restrooms.
He says airport cleaning crews work in tandem with the robot to keep the virus out. Zinnick signed one of its highest profile clients just this August, the NFL's Carolina Panthers. Eddie Levins is the director of team security. He says the robot is used in common areas of the stadium and places unseen by fans, like player locker rooms and equipment rooms. Levin spoke in a video released by the company.
One of our challenges was not just disinfecting rooms, but also things, whether it be keys and phones, but also football equipment, you know, helmets, shoulder pads, and other things, anything that players touch.
Corporate sales of such a device is big business, but Miller says his company has tried to make it more personal. Clients are encouraged to give their Zinnick robots a name.
It's easy for our customers to name the robots. We put on nameplates, so they have things like Germinator, R2 Clean 2, or if you know the Doctor Seuss books, Thing 1 and Thing 2.
The global market research firm, Technavio, reports the environmental disinfection robot market is poised to grow by more than $400 million by 2024 and says Zinnick is one of 9 major players in the industry. I'm Brian Kirkpatrick in San Antonio.
This is the Texas Standard, and my name is Gary Golio. Dark Was the Night, Blind Willie Johnson's Journey to the Stars, is a story about a very unusual human being. The reason I wrote it is because I think it kind of speaks to the magic and mystery of being a human being on planet Earth. He was a man born in the Pendleton Independence area of southern Texas in 1897. He was poor, and as a young boy, he had a beautiful, beautiful singing voice. Unfortunately, his mother died when he was about 5, and then he lost his sight when he was about 7 or 8. But he quickly recouped and became a popular singer in gospel circles, in churches at that time, and on street corners, singing with people like Blind Lemon Jefferson. Willie eventually made some records, some very popular records in the late 1920s, early 1930s. After the Depression, he kind of slid into obscurity, became a lay preacher, kept singing at churches, and died kind of sadly after a fire at his house. He died of pneumonia, and he was lost until the 1960s folk revival. When Reverend Gary Davis, a great blues player and teacher, turned a lot of his students on to the music of Willie Johnson. And in 1977-78, Carl Sagan, who was in charge of the Voyager space probe project at that time, asked music historian Alan Lomax, take a look at these selections we've made for this thing called the Golden Record. They were sending this beautiful record, this gold-plated copper record, up into space in the hope that someday, perhaps extraterrestrials would find this and learn something about the sights and sounds of planet Earth. And Alan Lomax listened. He said, Carl, this is great. You got Beethoven, Bach, Mozart on here, but there's one song that I think you're missing, and for me, it's the embodiment of human loneliness. And the song, of course, was Dark Was the Night by Blind Willie Johnson. It really is a marvelous, mystical, very mysterious song of him playing his guitar with his slide, and people from Eric Clapton to Jimmy Page and Led Zeppelin, Lucinda Williams, Jack White. If you ask them who's the greatest slide guitarist that they know of, they'll all say, Blind Willie Johnson. I'm Gary Golio, author of the book Dark Was the Night, Blind Willie Johnson's Journey to the Stars, and you are listening to the Texas Standard.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, proud to be a founding sponsor of the Texas Standard on public radio. Texas Mutual is a policyholder-owned workers' comp provider working to bring wellness into the workplace. More at texasmutual.com.
You got to tune to the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. During this election cycle, arguments over the Second Amendment were not front and center, but opinions on guns and access to them are still issues voters hold strong. Some of the loudest voices on guns of late have been some of the youngest, too. They're featured in a new podcast out of Texas called Gunplay. It's created and hosted by Jerome Weeks and Hadi Mawagdi from our partner station KERA, and Hadi joins us now. Welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me, David.
So you call your podcast Gunplay, which has obviously a suggestive and literal meaning. It's about a play, is that right?
Yeah, it is. So there's a theater company in Dallas called Cry Havoc, and they work with teens to create documentary-style theater projects. Their first was about the Dallas police shooting. Literally weeks after that Dallas police shooting, they were speaking to officers and to people who were on the scene, and they felt like there were more questions that needed to be asked. And after that, they went into a seventh-month journey into guns and gun culture and became NRA members, spoke to parents whose children were murdered and parents whose children took their own lives. We just followed them throughout the process.
How long has that process been going on, and why do you think their story has so much to teach the rest of us?
Well, you know, the process for the making of their play, which was called Babel and was sold out in the Dallas Arts District, took about 7 months. And that's from the interviewing to the script making to the live production. I think what makes it interesting is hearing kids react to the things that adults don't want to talk about anymore. Man, they say the most poignant things, and sometimes it's kind of obvious, but hearing it from someone who's 12, 13, sometimes 18 years old is just changing. It changes you.
Yeah. Well, I guess a big part of this is the fact that one of the issues that keeps guns in the national spotlight are school shootings, right? I mean, with everything else going on, this isn't something we've been dealing with of late as we have in years past, gratefully. But can you talk a little bit more about the role that school shootings play in your podcast?
Sure. So I should say, you know, school shootings make up some of the smallest percentage of shootings in America. One of the most important things that has to do with shootings and teens is actually suicide. And that's something that they focus on in their play. But they made this play in 2018, which was the deadliest year for school shootings in modern American history. And at the time, they were hiding under desks. They were learning how to go through metal detectors. And they were then going and talking to people who had been involved in school shootings. So it was really an overwhelming experience for these kids, sometimes emotionally, sometimes intellectually. But it really pushed them to think about things in a unique way. And at the end of it, some of them changed their minds on guns. They were anti-gun, and then they were like, I understand guns.
Interesting. Well, that's really interesting because it raises what I was thinking about, and that is quite often we don't have tough conversations about issues because one side is worried that the other is already baked in the eventual winner. And I know that in the issue of guns, there are a lot of people who are pro-Second Amendment who feel like almost anything that's presented, at least in popular culture, is anti-Second Amendment. Mm-hmm. What do you see as the goal of these young people? Are they trying to foster conversations, or do they want to see specific changes? Are they more in a sort of taking an activist position in terms of accomplishments or what they hope to achieve?
Well, I'll tell you, they probably have moved some of these individuals into more of like an activist form of thought. And they're a little honest about that. Their newer productions are, you know, it's hard to not be affected by the things you investigate. But we were with them during this process, and a lot of these kids just didn't know anything about guns. They hadn't ever shot a gun. They hadn't met people who had shot guns, or they only knew people who died from guns. So they were just raw, and they were speaking to adults who spoke to them like grownups. And I think they just really appreciated hearing that someone shoots because it's recreational, someone shoots because they need to protect their family and they want to be trained, or they also learn those really sad stories and really just what they thought could be done to change it. I mean, they met with Senator Cornyn during the middle of the Fix Nix Act in 2018, and even he told them more needed to be done to save lives when it came to guns and gun violence.
Hadi Mawagdi created and hosts the new podcast Gunplay with Jerome Weeks of KERA North Texas, and we've got a link to more at texasstandard.org. Hadi, congratulations on the launch of the new podcast, and thanks again.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. The U.S. Senator from Texas, Ted Cruz, recently said that President Donald Trump did not campaign on cutting the national debt. Is that a fact? Brandon Mulder looks into claims like these for PolitiFact Texas. He's based at the Austin American Statesman. Brandon, good to have you back on the big broadcast.
Good to be here, David.
So where did Ted Cruz make this claim? What was the context?
So this was last week during an episode on HBO in which Ted Cruz was in a conversation with political reporter Jonathan Swan of Axios. Mm-hmm. And this was taped immediately following the last presidential debate. And in that conversation, they engage in a back and forth about Trump and his handling of the U.S. national debt.
In fact, I understand we may have just a little bit of tape. Let's listen.
Do I wish that it was a higher priority for the president to rein in spending in the debt? Yes. He didn't run principally on reining in spending and deficit and debt. That's not what he promised to do. We had real differences between it. And you know what the voters made a decision.
I will remind you, he did promise to eliminate the national debt.
But let me give another element.
So Brandon, Ted Cruz is saying that reducing the national debt was not part of Trump's 2016 platform. I have to admit, I follow these things pretty closely, and I don't recall hearing Donald Trump talk much about debt or deficit.
Yeah, so in the episode, Swan claps back at Ted Cruz a little bit when he says that Trump had actually made that promise, specifically pointing to an interview with Trump and the Washington Post, where Trump said that he could erase the entire national debt in 8 years. So at the time, in 2016, that would have been about $20 trillion. Today, that number is nearly $27 trillion.
Yes, we've added quite a bit to the national debt as a result of this pandemic, that's for certain. But erasing a debt like that over the course of 8 years, would that be even possible?
Well, critics have called that idea wildly impossible, something that couldn't be done even if you eliminated all basic government functions and sold off all national assets. So a little bit later during his campaign, Trump walked back those comments, saying that he would reduce the debt by a portion rather than in totality, although, of course, that hasn't happened.
Is that the only time that President Trump made debt reduction part of his campaign?
So no. In fact, on the night he came down that escalator for his campaign launch, he talked about reducing the debt in his speech. His campaign website also talked about the enormity of the debt throughout 2016 as well. Then he talked about the debt during numerous rallies and media appearances. And of course, it came up multiple times during the presidential debates with Hillary Clinton. At one point, he was saying that he'll help pay off the debt by reviving the country's energy sector and making it more competitive. And of course, these same themes have continued into his presidency. For example, he's partly justified repealing the Affordable Care Act by saying that it would significantly reduce the federal deficit and debt.
Just to be clear, it sounds like a lot of these claims about reducing the national debt went back to 2016. This wasn't much of a feature, I would think, of the 2020 race, I would imagine, not with other issues crowding things out.
Correct. Yeah, we haven't heard about that as much as all the other issues on the menu this time around.
All right. So is it time for a rating here? We have enough information?
Yeah, so obviously Trump's many other campaign promises in 2016 got more airtime, you know, like building a southern border wall or changing trade relations with China or repealing Obamacare. But his campaign repeatedly raised concerns over the debt. So we rate this claim false.
False. Senator Ted Cruz's claim that Donald Trump did not campaign on eliminating the national debt. That ruling from Brandon Mulder with PolitiFact Texas. Brandon, thanks as always.
Thank you.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Wells Dunbar is monitoring the talk of Texas on this Thursday. Hello, Wells.
Hello, David. Well, elections, elections, elections. Everyone's still talking about elections, and we're hearing from some folks about elections through the perspective of social media. You touched on some pretty interesting stuff there in your conversation earlier with Omar Gayaga about the way social media has handled this election, trying to learn from the mistakes of 2016, but obviously still a lot of misinformation out there, and even the social media companies being stymied or attacked somewhat for their treatment of misinformation. So lots of perspectives out there, lots of interesting comments we're fielding via Twitter. This one from Samra. Samra says that Twitter's attempt at making people read articles or provide some more context before they retweet is useless. You can still retweet without reading. You just ignore the missive asking if you want to read the article first. And Jimmy O, Texas, he points on or picks up on an important aspect here, that all the sort of actions we see on problematic tweets, misinformation and whatnot, are user-driven. He notes that my hunch is that user reporting is also a big factor in Twitter flagging misleading tweets. Now, it was interesting to see yesterday and on Election Day, Twitter being very, very proactive in banning and restricting accounts that were fielding misinformation. So pretty quick on the trigger yesterday, which I think some people appreciate. Obviously, tensions running high out there, David.
Tensions are running high indeed. That's a hard task to try to police what people are saying on Twitter, and there are lots of people who don't get noticed whatsoever, and then they get flagged, and then that gets picked up, and then it gets amplified. Mm-hmm. And so I think that a question could also be raised about whether or not it's as effective as some who promote the process. I think it might be. Interesting.
Decidedly so. Yeah, as I've noted, tensions are running high. We've seen that in a few sort of high-profile incidents in some of these swing states or some of these states where ballots are still being tallied, places like Nevada, where we've seen some groups of protesters outside, some alleging without factual basis, some sort of nefarious things going on there with the count. So interesting perspective on it here via Facebook from one of our listeners, Roseanne Stogner. She says, God bless the brave citizens who have given their time, energy, and safety amid a pandemic to make sure that our votes are counted. She says she's sad to see that violence is still the answer, or the threat of violence, for some in the United States, and hope patriotic citizens who've sacrificed time and energy to make sure the votes are counted are kept safe. And we did see, I remember viewing on Twitter yesterday, a scene at the Nevada elections office, and what appeared to be like some SWAT officers basically on standby in case the people at work inside the office there needed a safe escort out home. So obviously, we're seeing incidents like that, but so far nothing that's there was a lot of worst case scenarios before the election, I think, and a lot of worry and concern. So far, we're not really seeing that wide, those fears come to pass, which I think is decidedly a good thing.
It does.
Obviously, this all transpiring in the background of the pandemic, and we passed that grim milestone yesterday, hitting 100,000 coronavirus cases, keeping a close eye on our friends in El Paso. New reporting here from KERA News. I think the city reported 3,100 new cases yesterday. So, yeah, stay safe out there, y'all.
This is a story we continue to track here at the Texas Standard. You can keep up with all the news 24/7 over at texasstandard.org. We're out of time for the broadcast, but we'll be back here tomorrow, and we hope you will join us. Till then, I'm David Brown, along with Wells Dunbar and the rest of the Texas Standard crew, wishing you a terrific Thursday.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Waldridge, Adrian Killam, the George Huntington Family, and the Cynthia and George Mitchell Foundation.